This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
From the Fox News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. What a week it's been already. Had a chance to do primetime the last two nights. Tonight, Laura Ingraham, that's part of it. Also, the pace in which things are happening with the law enforcement being fanned out through D.C. and possibly other cities. And the gerrymandering drama. Democrats could be heading home to Texas, allowing the quorum to take place and the redistricting to begin. So, and then, of course, the answer with Governor Newsom. So, and by the way, if you ever miss the show live, you're going to get the podcast, and you could always listen on the Fox News app if you have to leave our family of affiliates. But you also get the podcast on Brian Kilmeade Show, wherever you prefer to get the podcast, and millions do download. Daniel Hoffman in 35 minutes, former CIA station chief in this place called Russia, Iraq, and Pakistan. Big three.
Number three.
The conversation between Putin and Trump may be important for their bilateral, but they cannot agree on anything about Ukraine without us.
I agree, Mr. Zelensky, or President Zelensky, 2 days until the Alaska summit with Vlad and 1 day until his interview with us. I'm talking about President Trump. We're going to look at what Russia and the U.S. expect separately and the headlines that could emerge.
Number two.
What this tour is reflective of is the fact that Donald Trump is attacking this city. It's attacking its people. It's attacking the very fabric of what we call home. This is a tour against the Trump administration's attack on New York City voters.
That is Zohran Mamdani, the New York mayor race, a national event as Mamdani drops the gloves on Trump and Cuomo, and copycats emerge around the country, look like they're about to run other cities in a socialist fashion. Scary if you're a Democrat or an American.
Number one.
If he can get away with this in Los Angeles, if he can get away with this in D.C., it is a step in fascism when the federal government can bigfoot sovereign states.
Mayor Bowser, who has been rational, those quotes aside, D.C. crackdown goes into motion. 800 National Guards, 121 FBI flood the nation's capital, and other crime-ridden cities brace themselves for help. Yes, help. We look at crime and punishment under Trump, too. So should not be that controversial. You have cities that have a crime issue. Now, they got some stats that say assaults are down, murders are down, but they're way too high. And what happened is, if you combine that with the fact that almost every police force outside Nassau County, where I live, are understaffed, they can't fill up an academy, that's why President Trump says, I am not going to allow anarchy to take place, and we're going to begin in the nation's capital. And I think it's a good move. Crime is an issue. So you look at the numbers in D.C., and I think it's just Senator Van Hollen and Jamie Raskin say, the president's doing this to distract from Epstein. Guys, I hate to tell you, Epstein's out there, but that's dead. I looked at a CNN poll the other day, 93%. The searches on Google for Epstein down 93%, along with the attention the media is playing on him. But I found out that the whole genesis, they wanted to crack down on D.C. crime. He was embarrassed at how Joe Biden let it fall to pieces. But when they beat up Edward Korestein, who is the protege of Elon Musk, who is nicknamed Big Balls, right? Everyone has fun with that. But Korestein had become well-known among White House officials and well-liked. So he sees a carjacking going on, and he gets beat up basically within an inch of his death. Trump said, that's it, we're doing this. Within 8 days, he has this plan. And now yesterday, we see it in action. There are 800 cops short in D.C. He wants the place cleaned up, and he did it. They're moving. Secretary of Defense is moving. They are doing things. They called the mayor and informed her and told her, I'm not looking for input. You've been nice. I am looking for change. You combine that with the D.C. attorney, U.S. attorney, Jeanine Pirro, who wants to have a shot at prosecuting minors because they're perpetrating much of the crime, you have a situation that's going to get under control quick. And I look at what Ezra Klein said yesterday, a Democratic podcaster, who said Democrats should tread carefully on this because crime is real. It is not partisan. Here's Greg Pemberton, the D.C. Police Union chairman, on with Laura last night, cut 12.
We couldn't agree more with the president that crime in the D.C. area is out of control and something needs to be done about it. It's important to note how we got here, though. Back in 2020, the D.C. City Council passed the Comprehensive Policing and Justice Reform Act, which was a sweeping anti-law enforcement bill that was designed to hamstring cops. It was designed to reduce the size, scope, and responsibility of the police department. And really, it exposed officers to administrative, civil, and even criminal liability, even when they went out and did their jobs properly. It also made sure that there was nothing we could do to hold criminals accountable, even when we convicted them of crimes.
So, just so you know, they keep coming back to the mayor and say, well, crime is down. We, you know, this is really all a show. And she has been more diplomatic than I'm portraying. I understand that. And I'll play some of those sound bites. But there's two things happening. Number one, in the assaults in D.C., they've decreased 35% from 2024. But do you know in the assault categories, they didn't include felony and aggravated assault, which is significant when you figure out the total numbers? Did you know also in mid-May, the Metropolitan Police Department confirmed that they suspended an officer for skewing the numbers on the crime data? He accused his assistant police chief, Andre Wright, of doing that. But Michael Pulliam has been suspended with pay as they evaluate how he's messing with the numbers. So anecdotally, it's dangerous, more dangerous in D.C., just as dangerous as in years past. But statistically, it hasn't been. Now we find out you can't believe the stats again. Here's Ari Fleischer, Cut 16.
You know, it wasn't so long ago that President Bill Clinton ran on 100,000 new police officers in the United States, and all the Democrats in Congress were for it. And now the Democrats seem to be against having more of a police presence on the streets, especially in a federal city where it is constitutional for the president of the United States to exercise his powers to protect the people of D.C. You know, this argument that Democrats make that crime is down, this is like saying that crime used to be catastrophically high, and now it's only astronomically high, so we should all be glad that it's just astronomically high. If D.C. was a state, its murder rate would be the highest in the nation. Let that sink in when people hear that. Yes, it's down from its immediate pre-COVID level, but it's down to a horrible, miserable, dangerous level, which is why D.C. remains a dangerous place.
So I asked Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana last night if this works in D.C., and they have 30 days, and they got to go back to Congress and ask for more 30 or another 6 months, and it is costly. I get it. But what price do you put on safety, especially in our nation's capital, this tourist attraction? And I just want to say Michael Schellenberger alerted me the fact that I thought it was going to happen. It better happen. I want these National Guards members, other cops, not just to focus on the monuments and the graveyards. They're important. But I also want them to focusing on the projects in the working class areas where crime is really out of control, along with other areas a block from the White House where a guy got murdered just two nights ago. So here's what Senator John Kennedy says. Could it come to other cities? Cut 15.
Of course, D.C. is different. It's a federal enclave. We would have to be invited into other cities. But if it works, and it will, I would think other cities would welcome the additional help.
Yeah, I think so, too. And we'll have to see where we go from there. Mayor Brandon Johnson, Governor Pritzker, bracing for Trump's impact. Brandon Johnson, who's got 14% approval as he destroys Chicago. Instead of getting help on crime, he's braced for not helping on crime. Cut 17.
Well, he doesn't have the legal authority to do it, right? So let me just be very clear. He does not have the legal authority to do it.
Right. I'm not talking about the police force. I'm talking about the Insurrection Act and National Guard.
I'm saying he does not have. I know what you're talking about. He does not have the legal authority to do it. In fact, troops do not have policing power.
But the way they provide, they can also back up police officers. They can spell them, allow them to go back and do the investigation part of it. There are things they can do. And, of course, the deterrent factor can't be overestimated. So I want to fast forward and go talk about the New York mayor's race. Why? Because it's not a really New York mayor's race. It's called the changing of the party. The Democratic Party is not the same. If you look at the crowds that are coming out to see Democrats speak, they're coming out to see AOC and Bernie. You have a young socialist and a really, really old socialist who've never, by the way, accomplished anything legislatively in their lives, but they just make a lot of noise while, by the way, distancing themselves in many respects from their own party. So this mayor's race has got copycats. These are candidates who say, no, you could call me a socialist. I am a socialist. I don't like capitalism. Among them is the mayor over in Minneapolis. I mean, this guy literally from Somalia just a couple of years ago, he will gets the Democratic nomination against a sitting mayor who's terrible, by the way. This guy's name is Omar Fattah. One of the first things he says is, I'm going to, by the way, his party endorsed him, I'm going to make sure that 911 calls, half don't need to be responded to with armed officers. Then we're going to mount an offensive against the president's offensive, arresting illegal immigrants. And you got the same thing in Seattle. A female just won the mayor's race, who's in outright the nomination, and they're going to have a runoff in November. This is Democrat against Democrat. And there, she is a avowed socialist. So they're the ones getting the crowds and the votes. So am I to believe this is now Republicans against a socialist party and no longer a Democratic party? I do think that. And if I'm a Republican, I say, okay, look at the crowd in West Virginia. Look at that crowd over in Texas. These are red states. These are where the momentum is. We have to start game planning against that. So I asked Dan Torrentine last night this very question on primetime. So I asked him because he's known as a moderate. Bill Clinton, the successful president, even though with personal problems, was a moderate. Cut 28.
One of the mistakes that people make is they think that it's an either or. You either go to the middle or you go to the base. But winning campaigns appeal to both. Like one of Donald Trump, Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan's secret sauces is they're as popular on the factory floor in Scranton, Pennsylvania, as they are on Wall Street or Silicon Valley. And I think, you know, where AOC and Bernie missed the mark is they're only appealing to one side.
That's
they're
true.
Trashing the other, which is driving them right into Donald Trump's hands. Yeah. And the second thing is they lack the cultural respect for people. I mean, you were just talking about police or closing the border or, you know, trans boys playing little girls sports. And they say, if you don't agree with us, we're going to cancel you. So, I mean, I think we want their energy. We want the crowds that they're drawing, but we don't want them to lead our party in 2028 or even going into the midterms.
Man, is he sensible. Absolutely sensible. I'll give you an example. I think Mark Penn said on Monday he does not believe that Bill Clinton could get the nomination of the party today. And what Dan Torrentine said is interesting. Instead of saying, oh, that's scary about socialism, if you're a socialist, just say, listen, I'm fine with Democrats who want to be moderates. I'm fine with Democrats here. I'll work with the president when I can. But instead they say, screw you. Capitalism terrible. Billionaires are the enemy. We're going to tax the rich and get everybody out. So you created a problem not only with Republicans, which is expected, but with moderates like Fetterman, and then maybe there's not that many out there. And in theory, Governor Beshear, I couldn't give you his resume, but he's known in a Republican state as a Democrat as somewhat moderate. They say about Shapiro, even though I hate what he does on schools, he's somewhat moderate. I don't know what kind of crowd he's getting. If Shapiro had a rally tomorrow, could he fill up an arena? Could he fill up a small high school stadium? I don't think so. But Bernie Sanders is showing it. But he's not being inclusive. Do you know what he also did yesterday? He ripped Kamala Harris, which is fine, but it's just not politically smart. I don't think, but who knows? Bernie Sanders still viable at 84 years old, but still unaccomplished. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. It's Will Tane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Watch some of the news. I don't watch a lot of it anymore, but you watch it and these people are going nuts. Oh, this is, you know, what a win for Putin. He gets a meeting. He doesn't view it that way. A meeting is what you do to kind of figure out and make your decision. I want to have all the facts. I want to look this guy in the eye. And that's what the president wants to do. So honestly, you know, I think we're going to know very early in that meeting, you know, whether this thing has any chance of success or not.
Well, that is Marco Rubio on with Sid Rosenberg yesterday on WABC. And he just says the president wants to look him in the eye and wing it. And he says he's got great instincts. He knows human beings and he thinks he knows Putin. But there's a big risk tomorrow, I think, to a degree, even though Trump can spin his way out of it. I gave it a shot if worse comes to worse. But I think he goes to Alaska. He shows it from a military perspective how well armed Alaska is, just in case they have any ideas. I think there'll be a military show somehow, whether Trump walks amongst military equipment. But when they finally go to meet, I hope, this is what I hope. I hope that Trump has a few options to say that these are some of the things that we need. So rather than just saying, what do you think? I hope there's some options. But for the most part, the traditional way to do this is you have staffers talking, secretaries of states and foreign secretaries debating. And by the time the leaders walk up, there's just maybe four or five things to discuss. And if the prelims don't go well, you don't have a meeting. With the president, he got word from Witkoff there was some wiggle room. President makes a call. They have a conversation. They say, let's get together. Now they're getting together and it's being done. So now there's a meeting with the European Union. They have some parameters and protocols they want to relay. They know to be respectful to the president. The old guard was not. But here is Vladimir Zelensky. He's worried. Cut 29.
The conversation between Putin and Trump may be important for their bilateral, but they cannot agree on anything about Ukraine without us.
True. And I think this is the first phase. My sense is if there's some wiggle room and some give from Putin, who, by the way, is in the middle of a major offensive surge trying to get more land, which could also mean that he's ready to maybe have a ceasefire. I'm not sure. But there's got to be some strategy. I just don't think that Putin would think it's advantageous to him to fly to Alaska and not do anything. I mean, if you let's say you want to Trump, you know, okay. You realize Trump is the only one talking to you? So now you want to make the only person of power, a superpower, the number one military and economic superpower in the world, could help stand up your economy again? I think that he's more street smart than that. But I'm not a Russian. I'm not a Soviet. I'm not KGB. Here's more from Rubio.
Watch some of the news. I don't watch a lot.
It's insane how Putin has just completely disregarded what anybody else wants. What does your gut tell you about Friday's meeting?
Well, I think it's a feel-out meeting, to be honest. I think here's the way I would describe it. The president talked to Putin on the phone four times, okay? And, you know, nothing's come of it, or at least we haven't gotten to where we want to be. And so the president feels like, look, I got to look at this guy across the table. I need to see him face-to-face. I need to hear him one-on-one. I need to make an assessment by looking at him. And people have to understand, for President Trump, a meeting is not a concession.
And that's just it. And the Secretary of State will be there to support, offer advice, as long as he's also the National Security Advisor. So, and that's just it. I think as Mike Pompeo was great, but I think he's just a different approach than Marco Rubio, who I think is more advisor than Secretary of State. I think that if things go well and there's some movement, the best thing that could happen is next week, the president either meets with Zelensky or talks directly with Zelensky in order to set up a trilateral meeting. That's what you need to keep the ball moving. It looks like Brett Baer is going to talk to him before, and it looks like Sean Hannity will talk to the president after. But most importantly, we talk to the president tomorrow on this show at 10 a.m. Eastern time, 10 a.m., and we'll go as long as we can go. You know, so, and we'll see. We got some hard breaks. The president's got a country to run. And we'll see. And of course, there could be some type of thing that pops up that's an emergency that we have to postpone. But he likes this show, so we look forward to talking to him. Daniel Hoffman's next. And then I want to talk about this gerrymandering. There could be a break over in Texas. I'll explain.
This is Jason Chaffetz from the Jason in the House podcast. Join me every Monday to dive deeper into the latest political headlines and chat with remarkable guests.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com
or wherever you download podcasts.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Well, that's exactly Putin's strategy, as you say. He wants to deal directly with the U.S. over the heads of the Ukrainians and over the heads of the Europeans. But as we know, first off, President Trump is not in a position to cut a deal with Putin because it's not his territory. It's not his country. It's Ukraine. So the Ukrainians have to agree if there's going to be any deal. I don't think Trump's going to be very satisfied with the conversation, but I also don't think that he's ready to pressure Ukraine to accept a bad deal like that.
Right. I mean, look, he would love to have something quickly over. But if there is some promise, they move forward. If there is no promise, they don't move forward and the sanctions come on. One of the tactical questions I have is, would you, if you're Trump, mention it ahead of time? and say, by the way, I'm going to tell them the Senate sanctions that have passed with 85 votes are going to go into play if I don't feel you sincerely are looking for a ceasefire and end to this conflict. Daniel Hoffman joins us now, knows Putin more than anyone else in this country, perhaps, maybe the world, former CIA station chief who used to call Moscow home. Dan, what do you expect to happen?
Yeah, you know, look, I think there's going to be a frank exchange of views here, Brian. There's no question that the United States wants an end to this war. So does Ukraine. So does Europe. I think the only country that's demonstrated they don't want to end the war is Vladimir Putin. And I can tell you from experience that the intelligence community, the U.S. intelligence community, their input is critical. I expect that Director Ratcliffe and DNI Tulsi Gabbard are mounting their usual full-court press to ensure that the White House and President Trump are fully informed about what Putin expects to accomplish here. But what I think we're going to see is a lot of obfuscation from Vladimir Putin. I think he wants to split the war in Ukraine away from the overall U.S.-Russia bilateral relationship. He wants to deal with other issues like economic engagement and emerging from diplomatic isolation.
I'm fine with that, Dan. You know, if you say, okay, let's talk economy. Okay, we'll take 45 minutes. Let's talk about the things that will help you unmilitarize your economy, which is 45% military equipment. And then once they do that, say, okay, now let me tell you how you get there. And just flip it back, correct?
Yeah, and arms control. There are a whole lot of issues.
Sure.
You know, we should be talking to Russia, and that's a good thing. But the question is whether Putin is going to be at all sincere about ending the war.
Yep.
And look, Putin is a rational actor. We might not think of him as such because he's caused a million casualties for just his own country, let alone the death and destruction that he's caused in Ukraine. But from his perspective, it's rational. He's perfectly okay spilling massive bloodshed in Ukraine to fight this losing war because he believed Ukraine, as it's currently constituted as a free democracy, is an existential threat to Russia. He wants a puppet government, puppet regime in Kyiv. And that's the hurdle we're going to have to get over. There are many who believe that this war isn't going to end until Putin is no longer sitting in the Kremlin. I guess we'll get the answer to that, or at least the beginnings of that, on Friday.
So I think we're getting this. Caroline Levitt said, you know, this is going to be a listening opportunity to hear where they stand. And then Marco Rubio said the president likes to look somebody in the eye. It's everything about the president domestically and internationally is unorthodox. And I think people are used to that by now. But I'm just wondering if it hurts a negotiation to do it like this, because I also think, to a degree, Dan, that the KGB guy is used to being able to disseminate and work, do a 180 around their subject. Trump is not open to that. It's almost as if he's like, oh, yeah, you could do your profiles all you want, but this is what I want. So,
yeah.
And I know, you know, we know the flattery thing. Okay. But that doesn't mean that's not going to work here.
Well, it didn't work in Hanoi in February of 2019.
You were there.
President Trump met with Kim Jong-un. I was there. And President Trump walked away from a bad deal. Putin is trying his usual KGB tactics. He's talking about framing the war in Ukraine as a real estate deal, land swaps and things like that, which ignores the fact that Ukraine needs to have you know, a fortified demarcation zone, the line of contact that exists right now to deter any future Russian attack. So there's a lot of devil in the details. Yeah, in the old days, we used to work our way up with low-level meetings all the way up to the summit where we would accomplish something and sign some deals. President Trump likes to do it the reverse. And look, the other way wasn't working either. So now we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, I mean, it's the hope is if you get by Putin, there might be a Yeltsin who, hardly traditional, obviously an alcohol problem, but was not looking to reconstitute the Soviet Union. How hopeful are you that after Putin, whenever that is, we get a different mindset?
Yeah, I'm not super hopeful. It's hard to be optimistic about Russia. Look, when the Soviet Union collapsed, it did present all sorts of opportunities. And the only piece of the Soviet Union that didn't collapse, and I can tell you because I spent a lot of time in Russia in the 1990s, was the KGB successor intelligence services that were surveilling us in Moscow and running high-profile spies like Rick Ames and Robert Hansen in the United States. So it wasn't a surprise to us that emerging from that post-Soviet apocalyptic wasteland would be the KGB guy, Vladimir Putin. I think if Putin goes, the guys who are currently the strongest, that's the Federal Security Service, which Putin used to lead, the FSB, those guys, the military, they're the ones most likely to take over for Putin and continue this hard line, unless they see that this war has been such a loser that there are opportunities for them economically to stop the aggression overseas, stop their alliance with China and North Korea and Iran, and open up to the West. There's always been that tension in Russia. But the one thing I would caution for us in the United States, what really drove President Biden's presidency just completely to where he didn't want it to be and made him super unpopular was the way he handled Afghanistan. Americans wanted us out, but they were rightly critical of Biden for being just so feeble in the conduct of the withdrawal and just being unable to see the reality for what it was. Even days before the Taliban took Kabul, President Biden was still talking about how the Afghan army was going to hold strong. So that's the key for President Trump, I think, for him carrying on, you know, his presidency with domestic and foreign priorities, is how he will be perceived for handling Vladimir Putin. He's going to go do some serious negotiation on Friday, and the world, especially China, will be watching.
So Vladimir Putin had a phone call with Kim Jong-un yesterday. I'm sure the timing is intentional, where he thanked him for the use of his soldiers and in turn for the technological equipment they've given back. One of the bad parts from America's perspective, my perspective, yours, is that they have now have more of an open alliance, correct?
Yes, they do. And Vladimir Putin wants to make it clear to the United States that North Korea can be more of a thorn in our side. And so that, hence that discussion with Kim Jong-un. It didn't have to be publicized, but it was, as a message to President Trump that Russia can deliver pain to the United States in the Pacific as well. And that's part of that. And part of the fact, too, that Putin wants to demonstrate that he's got some staying power in Ukraine with North Korean munitions and North Korean soldiers, cannon fodder. And some of the North Korean workers who have been helping to rebuild some of the areas in what used to be Ukraine, and Russia has taken over.
Are you going to go, Dan?
I am not headed to Alaska this time, Brian. But who knows? Someday down the road, I'll get a chance. I was in Helsinki for that summit, and it's always, you know, interesting to cover the summit like firsthand and be there in person. And we're going to have great coverage from Fox News out there. I'm looking forward to commenting on it in the coming days.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting because from the European perspective, they're hoping to get their point across. What do you think? You know, the way they act more at the traditional diplomatic handbook. What do you think? And they know the president now. They know they're not going to sit there and be dismissive like they were in 2017. What do you think the message they're going to give the president today when they have that meeting?
I think what they're going to say is that, look, please don't negotiate on Ukraine's behalf without them being there. The Russians have this great saying, "Без меня меня женили," I was married without being present. It's usually a saying that's reserved for the guys who have to go clear the mines in you know, the Russian army, and they're both sent to do that, even though they didn't volunteer to do it. Ukraine's not at the table, and that's not a great look for us if the president makes a deal that's not considered to be very good for Ukraine, and by extension, Europe, and us as well, since we enjoy $1 trillion worth of trade with Europe, and the last thing we want is for Putin to cast a dark shadow over that with threats to Europe if he were to take over Ukraine. So I think the president was right. President Trump was right to say he's going to be in listening mode. He's going to call Zelensky first. But it was clear Putin wasn't interested in meeting with President Trump and Zelensky to solve anything. And yeah, so that does put some limits on where we're going to be going here.
Yeah. And by the way, Vladimir Putin has sent about 110,000 soldiers into two separate areas at the front to try to make as much gains as possible before these talks start. In an odd, twisted way, is that some way of showing that maybe he knows a ceasefire could happen?
Possible. But also, there are other reasons for doing this. We're headed into, you know, we're in the summer fighting season. We've got, I don't know how long, it depends on the weather, a month, maybe 6 weeks before things start to get a little bit dicier for the Russians in their offensive. And so this is the time, it would be the time anyway, for them to be launching the most assaults on Ukraine. And it's fitted. It's very much Putin's strategy. He hasn't let up at all. And had he been serious, perhaps, about negotiating with the president, maybe he would have agreed to a ceasefire until we have these discussions. even just a week or two, but he didn't do that either. So that clearly, you know, the underlying point too for me, Brian, and I can't get past this, and forgive me because I served in Russia for a long time and I spent a lot of time seeing the world through Putin's twisted KGB eyes, but Putin hates us. He hates President Trump. He hates Democrats. He hates Republicans. He hates our country, democracy, liberty, freedom, the Constitution, all those things. The last thing he wants is to elevate our status as the global superpower that stopped the largest land war in Europe since the Second World War. So I think what he wants is to show that he can assert his primacy over his own self-designated sphere of influence in the former Soviet Union. That's the challenge for President Trump, who, by the way, is trying to do the right thing and stop this bloody war. But the way to do it probably is to defeat Putin, not to negotiate with him. And that may be the conclusion we draw on Friday afternoon.
And, you know, I'm firmly in Ukraine's court. And if it means doubling, tripling down on the arms we give them, I'm all for that. I think I'm one of the minority listening to us right now, but I thoroughly believe it. Dan, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
All right. Have a good day.
You got it. Daniel Hoffman, a reality check there for what could happen in Alaska. Should know your opponent. He knows it. 1-866-408-7669. I know you have a lot to say, so let's hear it.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is Jimmy Fallon, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Putin's on the march. He could continue to march, and then it could involve Estonia, 40% Russian. It could involve Poland, and that's how major wars start, in Poland, in places like Estonia. And unless someone thinks that we can live entirely protected by the Atlantic and Pacific and not care at all, as we thought in the 30s, that affects us.
So that is Charles Krauthammer, not cut from the pages. Sadly, he passed away years ago. But in March 18, 2014, he had Putin's number because Putin is trying to reconstitute the Soviet Union. That's why Estonia, Lithuania, as well as Latvia are worried, the Baltics. That's why Finland and Sweden have jumped into NATO territory now. That's why Germany is now finally going to invest in their defense. For a while, constitutionally, we wouldn't let them. Now we're all for it, as we are with Japan. So they get it. They get the threat. This is where, on top of that, the Russians have lost 1 million people. On top of that, they had to make huge purchases of Iranian drones. On top of that, they had to borrow or use thousands, tens of thousands of North Korean troops and Yemeni troops that have flooded into the zone because they're running out of people. They had to beg prisoners to say, hey, if you don't mind going to the front lines, I'll let you out of prison. So I'll watch all that today. Meanwhile, fascinated to see what happened yesterday in the market because inflation stayed pat. So here we are 6 months into April, May, June, July, August, 4.5 months since the tariffs liberation day. And there's no market inflation. There's up percentage points, down a percentage point. So the market soared yesterday. It's up 400 points today. Scott Bessent, who all the way, even though he's got a traditional financial background, unbelievably successful, a guest of our show, we're proud to say, for 2 years prior to him getting the job as Secretary of Treasury, was on with Larry Kudlow yesterday. And he said, listen, guys, admit it. The Fed was wrong. And the detractors were wrong when it comes to tariffs. Cut 41.
Not only were the fantastic numbers, is that a lot of the economists said, well, I got the number right, but I missed the components. Mm. And everyone was expecting that there would, as you just said, that there would be goods inflation. Mm. But there was actually this very odd service inflation. There were some healthcare services. There were airline prices, which, as far as I can tell, has nothing to do with tariffs. Mm. You know, I'm starting to think, you know, TDS. Used to mean tariff derangement syndrome. Now it's kind of turning into tariff Domkoff syndrome.
Yeah.
I mean, they just, you know, when you're in a hole, stop digging.
And what he's trying to do is get a deal done, and they admit they're stuck when it comes to India. And they're trying to get that done quickly, and we'll see where they go from there. But the president and the Treasury Secretary have been on the same page. That also helps, doesn't it? Scott Bessent went on to talk about what is coming in, and that is revenue. Revenue, and it's a lot of revenue. Cut 44.
Just on the tariff income, I'd been saying $300 billion, but I think we're going to have to substantially revise that up. So well in excess, 1% of GDP. And then with the new investments, they're the sovereign investments that we talked about. Mm-hmm. But then in terms of the committed investment by private industry, we're well over $10
trillion. $10 trillion. And they think by, at the end of this year, $300 billion to $500 billion. So they're starting getting on the positive side of things. So you got the big, beautiful bill that's working. They got to sell it and they got to market it. One thing that the Democrats have to be upset about is because they fell into the Epstein trap. And I do think it's a trap because more Democrats were involved with Epstein than Donald Trump ever was. Any Republican, by the way, I think zero Republicans. So I do think that allowed them to get off topic and not talk about what they didn't like about the big, beautiful bill, which is now law. And what Donald Trump's got to get back to since it passed, he doesn't talk much about it. I think he's got to go back in and start speaking about it. Because right now they're trying to vilify it, and there's so much to sell on. It's not a perfect bill. Maybe there is spending too much, but they believe revenue will replace the spending. But if you see what they're doing on energy, you see what they're doing with the wall, you see what they're doing with no taxes on tips, you see the money they're getting. By the way, they doubled the child tax credit. So for those single moms out there, those two working families, you're going to get a relief in that respect. So there's going to be a lot of things going on. This economy is going to boom if they can keep the world straight. We don't want any major conflicts. And to make sure of that, we have to make sure our defense is strong. That's the deterrent we're looking for. For the president to make this a great 4 years, he needs the next 2 years. And that's why he's pushing so hard to redistrict in Texas. It is, I got to get this result. It's better for the country, certainly for my agenda. So let's go back in and get some seats. It looks like, according to ABC and Fox confirmed too, that Democratic lawmakers who are part-timers who were in Illinois are coming back. So they'll give them the quorum. I'm not sure if they're ever going to get paid. They got to pick up their paychecks in person. So they got to go show up. So I'm not sure how this is going to play out, but they're going to get their vote and they're going to do it. Gavin Newsom says, I'm going to redistrict in California. I got news for you. Texas got a much stronger hand. And guess who else is ready to go? Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida and the governor of Indiana. They have much more to play here. This is the Brian, but it's chaotic. I get it. Brian Kilmeade Show. History, Liberty, and Laughs. I'll be in Dallas, Texas, Saturday night. Next Saturday night.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone, from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where the city, according to Eric Adams, is safe. So that's good enough for me. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. The mayor's race has got national attention, no doubt about it. This hour, I'm going to be joined by Kenneth Spencer, chairman of the United States Park Police Fraternal Order of Police. And why Ken is special is Ken has got an enhanced role with this new law enforcement that has fanned out across D.C. If it can work here, maybe it could help springboard if it's a system that they can set up and straighten things out in Chicago. It's going to be hard with an uncompliant mayor and governor in Oakland. I mean, the cities that are really bad, like Philadelphia and Baltimore. We'll see how that takes place. Karl Rove is standing by. So, and we have so much to talk to him about. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Tomorrow's move of president. Conversations between Putin and Trump may be important for their bilateral, but they cannot agree on anything about Ukraine without us.
That is true, President Zelensky. 2 days until the Alaska summit with Vlad and 1 day into the interview with our show. I'm talking about President Trump, not Putin. And what Russia and U.S. can expect to get out of this headline-grabbing, I guess, summit?
Number two.
What this tour is reflective of is the fact that Donald Trump is attacking this city. It's attacking its people. It's attacking the very fabric of what we call home. This is a tour against the Trump administration's attack on New York City voters.
Zoran Mamdani, New York mayor race, a national event as Mamdani drops the gloves on Trump and Cuomo as copycats emerge around the country and threaten to marginalize the Democrats' Big Ten party.
Number one.
If he can get away with this in Los Angeles, if he can get away with this in D.C., it is a step in fascism when the federal government can bigfoot sovereign states. Ugh,
believe me, Mayor Bowser, D.C. crackdown goes into motion. 800 National Guards, over 100 FBI agents flood the nation's capital, and other crime-ridden cities can brace possibly for some help, although they don't seem to want it. Karl Rove, former deputy of staff for George W. Bush, senior advisor there, Fox News contributor, best-selling author. Karl, what do you think about the president's crime problem, attack plan?
Well, look, we saw a little bit of this in Los Angeles where there were, you know, disturbances. He has special authorities that allow him to, for a limited period of time, to control the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C.
30 days, right?
Yeah, 30 days under the home rule law. It's not clear to me that he has authority to deploy federal forces and National Guard into the other cities just because he believes that the crime rates there are too high. It's one thing going back to remember in Portland several years ago when left-wing demonstrators were trying to attack the federal courthouse, sure, that he would have authority under federal law to deploy federal forces in order to stop that. And they did send additional federal law enforcement there, but he would have authority to do things in a situation like that. It's unclear what authority he would have to deal with crime in Oakland or Philadelphia or Baltimore, as opposed to Washington, D.C., which is, you know, has a special district that has governed by a specific law that gives him specific authority for 30 days to basically take command of the Metropolitan Police Department.
You know, the most deceptive thing, and Ari Fleischer talked about it last night, is everyone says, well, crime's down. Why now? Well, I mean, there's little things that are going on when it comes to crime figures. The thing that emerged yesterday out of the D.C. figures, they left off felony and aggravated assault in their violent crime categories. Also, they have a little problem with the Metropolitan Police. They suspended one of their guys for skewing the crime stats. So he's suspended with pay. So, I mean, you got to wonder. And plus, Karl, you know more people in Washington than almost anybody. You know they don't feel safe like they used to.
Yeah, no, they don't. Having said that, remember, this was not a response by the administration to a judicious study of the crime statistics. True. And finding fault with them. This was a brutal assault on a former Doge employee at 3 a.m. in the morning. With what turns out to be pretty typical in the last couple of years, he is assaulted by three individuals who are attempting to steal his car, and I believe they're all underage. I mean, what we've got in Washington, D.C. is because of D.C. laws passed by the city council, they treat juvenile defendants in violent acts significantly different than they do adults in those acts. So what happens? The gangs go out and say, we're going to get the 14 and the 15-year-old to basically steal the luxury car at 1 a.m. And so, this is a little bit of the D.C. having to deal with a problem that it created by being lax on crime.
Absolutely, especially with teens. So I'm watching the mayor of Baltimore, and you know what a mess Baltimore is, how dangerous it is. The mayor of Baltimore, obviously a Democrat, who thought it would be a great idea just to not wear a tie or a jacket, just hop on CNN. I just think it's a bad presentation. Having said that, the Baltimore Sun did a story about how bad things are using real people talking about how bad things are in Baltimore. So he was confronted with this, and if Trump could help. Cut 22.
I'm sure you read the article in the Baltimore Sun yesterday talking about how so many Baltimore residents don't recognize their neighborhoods anymore. What do you say to those residents of Baltimore who may think that citing falling crime statistics glosses over some of the harsher day-to-day realities and needs that they have to their lives in Baltimore, need for things to change even further in terms of just regular drug trafficking?
Yeah, so we're only having that discussion because the president is having that discussion. And this, I want to be very clear. I didn't read the Baltimore Sun article. I don't read it because they're a part of the president's propaganda machine.
Really? Baltimore Sun? Is that the answer you expect?
God, what a moron. I'm sorry. That's just ridiculous. Look, this is a big problem for the Democratic Party, because most big city mayors are Democrats. You know, Dallas has a Republican mayor, Fort Worth has a Republican mayor, but those are the largest cities in America with Republican mayors. And most of these other city mayors are big city mayors are Democrats. And if they are soft on crime, that's the face of the Democratic Party. If, you know, look, I'm old enough to remember when you had Democrats who felt seriously about making certain that the inner city neighborhoods were safe. And this guy, that's a joke.
I know.
I mean, how out of touch is he? The Democratic Party, if it would wake up, would realize that saying we're going to make certain that the neighborhoods and communities inside our big cities are safe, that would be something that would put them in good stead with the voters back home, but also help change the view that we have in America today that the Democratic Party, when it comes to crime, is soft. And they are.
So I want to talk about gerrymandering. The ABC had a report last night that some Democratic lawmakers, state lawmakers, were coming home so you could have a quorum today about redistricting in your state, Karl Rove. What have you heard?
Well, look, 9 Democrats never left the state, and I understand there's a 10th one whose name has not been added to the list, who's around town. They need to have 12 Democrats join with the 88 Republicans in order to have 100 members present out of 150. That would constitute a quorum. We have a very high threshold for what a quorum consists of. But look, I don't think this is going to happen before the end of this first called session. I think the governor's going to have to call a second one. But look, they're going to come home. You know, first of all, this always happens. They run away, but eventually they have to come home because, look, first of all, they only get paid $600 a month, which means each one of these people has a real job they're staying away from, and their families. And second of all, Speaker Burroughs has taken some very tough, smart measures. He said, okay, if you want to get your paycheck, and more importantly, if you want to get your per diem, we only pay them $600 a month, but we pay a nice per diem while they're in session. If you want to pick up either one of the, if you want to get receive either of those checks, we're no longer making auto deposit into your account. You got to pick them up in person. And then he said, any member who is not here, we're going to cut your staff budget by 30%, which means every one of these people is going to have to fire an employee, and they only have 2 or 3 employees. This is going to be so he's pinching them. So look, this is going to happen. It's probably going to take a second special called session. This one ends legally on the 19th. The governor can literally call a session to begin immediately. What's going to happen is we'll end up with 100 members. The speaker will put on what's called a call. He'll put a call on the House, which means that literally no member can leave the floor of the House without his written permission. And we'll end up doing, you know, the redistricting plan, and we'll end up doing some of the bills that have been added onto the special call to deal with the aftermath of the Guadalupe River flood.
And here is the backlash from Gavin Newsom. Listen.
Hey, President Trump, it's time to stand down. It's time to, dare I say, do the right thing. Actually, see how that feels for you, doing the right thing. If you don't, California will neutralize anything you do in the state of Texas. We're not going to sit back and watch you light democracy on fire. We will fight fire with fire.
Take that apart, if you will, Carl.
Don't do something that I consider to be anti-democratic, namely gerrymandering. I've already done it in California, so don't criticize me or the Illinois governor or the New York governor for having gerrymandered their states. Texas, 2/3 of the delegation are Republicans. In California, it is 83% of the delegation are Democrats. So I've already gerrymandered, he says. And if you gerrymander in Texas, well, I'm going to do a second round of gerrymandering, and it's all because you're being anti-democratic. Well, what do you call gerrymandering your state? In fact, I loved it. They had a commission draw the lines. And after they drew the lines, all these special interest groups said, look at how we manipulated the process so that we would have more Democrats in the congressional delegation. I mean, come on, please stop being a hypocrite. Stop. Do I wish that we only redistricted every 12 years? Am I uncomfortable with the degrees to which both parties go? Yes. Do I wish more states were like Iowa, where they draw the lines in such a way that they're compact and contiguous and community of interest and have more competitive seats? Yes. But this is what it is, and it's been this way since before the term gerrymandering was created in 1812. So stop, please, Newsom. Stop lecturing us like you are high and mighty, and you realize that you're doing something bad, Donald Trump, so therefore I'm going to do something even worse.
You think Florida's going to do the same thing? I think they're heading down that way.
We'll see. I mean, it's, you know, at some point this just gets crazy. And look, let me just be clear. Everybody does this. I remember in 2016, 2015 and 2016, when the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, directed four states that they had to redo their redistricting in the middle of the decade in order to create more black majority seats, and it cost Republican seats in most of those states. The two Republicans lost their seats in North Carolina because of the Justice Department stepping in and saying, you must do this, and you must do it in a way that will guarantee more Democratic seats. So everybody does this. Do I like it? No. But please, let's not go out there and have holier-than-thou lectures from a guy who's got great hair. I have to admit that about Newsom, great hair, but not a particularly effective governor.
Terrible governor and not sincere about a word he says. He comes off totally distrustful. And I know people that are sincere, even if you don't believe anything, and you go, well, he's sincere. And maybe Governor Westmore's like that. I don't see it in Gavin Newsom. I see nothing but distrust. And in California, he's got 38% approval rating. And that's a Democrat. Not easy. So finally, Carl, I want to bring you to what you expect to happen in this unorthodox setup in Anchorage, Alaska. It looks like we now know that the Vladimir Putin will meet with Donald Trump at a U.S. military base in Anchorage. Your thoughts about what we'll be talking about Friday night when it's over?
Well, we don't know. And maybe we shouldn't, because this is, you know, high stakes. This will determine, this could determine the outcome of the conflict in Ukraine. And it could either be to the advantage of the United States and the West, or it could be to the advantage of Vladimir Putin and to the disadvantage of the United States over the long haul and to Europe almost immediately. So we don't know. I do think that there are signs that President Trump has come to understand that Vladimir Putin is not sincere about wanting to have peace. He wants what he wants, which is the decimation of Ukraine and the creation of a vassal state in Ukraine, and the end of its freedom, and the beginning of again of domination by Moscow. But we'll see what happens. But for this will go. This is one for the history books. This is going to be a moment where Donald Trump demonstrates leadership or not, and where either the United States is a force for peace and security and our interests or not. And we'll see. High stakes.
This meeting came about because the president of Russia asked the president of the United States to meet through his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, who, as you all know, traveled to Russia to have a conversation with Putin at his request. And so the president is agreeing to this meeting at the request of President Putin. And the goal of this meeting for the president is to walk away with a better understanding of how we can end this war.
So, you read between the lines there. They're kind of walking back expectations and let everybody know why this is happening, right?
Smart. Lower the expectations, because the expectations got way out of whack very quickly. And Russia wanted that. Russia wants the pressure to be on Donald Trump to, you know, deliver and deliver a peace regardless of what the consequences of that might be over the short term or long term. And I thought it was very wise by the White House to begin to lower the expectations on it and to say the president wants to hear from Putin and understand where he's coming from. But look, to a large degree, we know that. He had, you know, this is a guy who said, think about what he proposed. Putin said, well, I want the rest of the Donbass. I want territory that I didn't already illegally invade and occupy. I want the rest of it. And then I'm willing to give you a ceasefire, which is, you know, gives me time to rebuild my military so I can take the rest of Ukraine. And I don't want I don't offer security guarantees. I want you to take NATO off the NATO membership off the board. I mean, everything for Russia, nothing for Ukraine.
That's why if he walks in with that, this things will be over in 20 minutes, especially if he doesn't want to budge.
So.
Carl Rove, thanks so much. Fascinating times. Appreciate it.
Great to be on with you.
We have like four number one stories. I'm so glad you're there, too. Back with phone calls, and then Ken Spence will bring us inside the D.C. Law enforcement message. Don't move.
You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. When you visit the doctor, you probably hand over your insurance, your ID, and contact details. It's just one of the many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose it, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, coming up, I just got to remind you on the 23rd, I know it's not this Saturday, the Saturday after, Dallas, Texas. I know you heard about it. Will Kane, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West is going to be with us. Some other surprises. We got four tiers to fill up. I looked this morning. It looks like the floor is almost done. The second tier is sold out. The third tier is two-thirds sold out. I got four or five tiers to get through. So it's a beautiful venue, the biggest one we've ever played at. If you want inspirational, patriotic, you got it all, and entertaining. So we have a lot of fun. We've been doing this for 2 years. It'll be streamed on Fox Nation, but there's something about seeing it in person. And then, of course, VIP opportunities. We've got the biggest VIP I've ever had, over 100. Usually it's a couple of dozen that's supposed to be exclusive, but now everybody wants the VIP. So I talk to you before the show, give you previews, answer your questions, and then sign my books. Thomas Jefferson, the Tripoli Pirates, George Washington, Secret Six, went over 1 million copies sold. Andrew Jackson, Miracle of New Orleans, Sam Houston, of course, the Alamo Avengers. I'll make a big deal of that. All right, keep it here. When we come back, Kenneth Spencer tells us what's happening in Washington, how it's going to work, some of the pushback that will happen if we decide to do this in other cities. But the Park Police have a surprising role in this. I didn't know much about it. Paul Morrow told me. We'll get the details next.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
It is also true that we experienced a crime spike post-COVID. But we worked quickly to put laws in place and tactics that got violent offenders off our streets and gave our police officers more tools, which is why we have seen a huge decrease in crime because of those efforts. And we're at a 30-year violent crime low.
Well, the little problem with that, we have somebody that got suspended for messing with the crime stats, and then we find out that two important elements of the assaults were not registered. And there's a sense in D.C. that the place is not safe. Kenneth Spencer joins us now. He knows the reality of it. He's chairman of the United States Park Police Fraternal Order of Police, and he joins us now. Ken, welcome.
Brian, thanks for having me. How are you doing?
Good, good. So, Ken, what is the role of the Park Police in this new comprehensive effort that includes 800 more law enforcement personnel?
Okay. I mean, I guess I'll start with, for people that aren't from the D.C. area, if you're not familiar with the U.S. Park Police around here, they know who we are, but we have full authority in the District of Columbia, just like the D.C. police. So we patrol the entire city, but we also, we have the core monuments downtown, the Lincoln Memorial, the National Mall, all the icons that you see when you come to D.C., but we're also responsible for the highways, the parkways that come in and out of the city, like the Baltimore-Washington Parkway and a lot of the environs of the District of Columbia and Virginia and Maryland. So we have a huge footprint and a huge responsibility in the D.C. area. We also have a field office in New York where we patrol Fort Wadsworth on Staten Island, the beaches of Brooklyn. We had to deal with that migrant facility up in Floyd Bennett Field. And we also have sole responsibility for the police services in Presidio in San Francisco.
What do you men and women tell you about the condition of things in crime and punishment in D.C.?
Well, just like any police officer in D.C., the way it's been for a long time is you arrest somebody and they're out the next day or that same day. It's even for serious crimes like carrying a pistol without a license or, aggravated assault and things to that nature.
So are things bad? Do you think we need the National Guard?
I mean, everybody's short-staffed as far as policing goes, and that falls back.
We're about 800 short, right?
For our agency, we're supposed to have upwards of 100. One study will tell you 820 officers, and that's force-wide across all three of our field offices, like I mentioned, D.C., San Francisco, New York. So we're supposed to have around 820. The Park Service, for some reason, says we need 639. I don't know where they came up with that number. But either way, we're short. We have fewer officers right now than we had in 1975. We have 504 sworn officers, and that's from the chief all the way down to the lowest ranking officer on the force. And that's to handle three major cities. So, and I know, you know, my friend Greg Pembertini is the D.C. chief chair, D.C. police chairman of the FOP for them, the D.C. police union. We're the primary officers that you're going to see in D.C. is the D.C. police and the U.S. Park Police. We roam around the city arresting people.
So here's Greg Pemberton. You just mentioned him. He's a D.C. police union chair. Cut 12.
We couldn't agree more with the president that crime in the D.C. area is out of control and something needs to be done about it. It's important to note how we got here, though. Back in 2020, the D.C. City Council passed the Comprehensive Policing and Justice Reform Act, which was a sweeping anti-law enforcement bill that was designed to hamstring cops. It was designed to reduce the size, scope, and responsibility of the police department. And really, it exposed officers to administrative, civil, and even criminal liability, even when they went out and did their jobs properly. It also made sure that there was nothing we could do to hold criminals accountable, even when we convicted them of crimes.
Do you recognize these issues?
We do. We do. And this, what I was about to say is that the D.C. police and the U.S. Park Police, we've had people walking out the door. We have serious retention issues. And that all stems back from basically, you know, the riots in 2020 and then everything that happened after that. I mean, we were standing in front of the White House for weeks, you know, watching things get burned and just total chaos. A lot of we had 52 officers injured over that weekend. You didn't see that in the news cycle at all.
Nope.
And it's a disgrace what happened. And then they lied about why, you know, we went out there and cleared the streets. They tried to say it was for President Trump to do a photo op, which was completely bogus. It was years later that they did an investigation and found out we were really just trying to clear the street so we could get a fence erected to calm down the chaos that was happening in the streets there. But regardless, ever since that happened, we've had people walking off the job, and we have no retention incentives at all to keep officers on this job. And plus with the, you know, the way things are now, it's almost like the officer has to go up there and testify on why he did his job instead of, you know, holding the criminals accountable for what they did. It's almost like interrogating the officer for arresting somebody instead of putting the criminal in jail and holding them accountable for the actions. Like, the actions of the criminal is the problem, not the actions of the officer responding to what they're doing.
So how do we reverse that? I think the president should try to shake up the system. I'm going to put these National Guards out there. I'm going to put 121 FBI people out there. I'm going to get some coordination between all elements, and we're going to do this for 30 days, and we're going to start making a difference. I think that's his approach. Do you think it'll be effective?
I think it'll be effective temporarily. I mean, but let's be honest. We have a problem with police in the United States across the nation, especially in the big cities.
How do we change that? How do we change that? The laws that Jeanine Pirro wants to do, Judge Pirro wants to do? Or is it an attitude, or is it actually financial incentives?
I think it's both. Right now, of course, we want criminals to be held accountable to make our jobs easier. So when we know we're arresting somebody, there's going to be a consequence for that person. We're not going to have to go out there and do it again. But I can't speak for every police department, but I've been working with Congress for years. Our best friend in there is Representative Nicole Malliotakis by far. She's introduced a bill for us. This is the third time we've had the same bill introduced.
Right.
H.R. 1260, the U.S. Park Police Modernization Act. And I met with Secretary Burgum, and I told him that this needs to be done. We were trying to get that enacted. All it does is put us on equal footing with other federal law enforcement agencies so that when, especially military veterans, we age out before you're allowed to meet your max pay for your pension and your retirement. So all this does is just compress everything that so you can have the biggest pension that you can possibly have for doing your job. And that's just a small, very cheap incentive that we've been trying to do, but it's been ignored. And the officers were pretty upset when the DOI appropriations bill came and went. And, you know, especially with the secretary, he knew about it. And we were a little upset that that didn't happen. But, I mean, we're happy that Secretary Burgum and President Trump vocally support us. But something needs to be done that's real, where the officers who are on this job feel it. And then they're not going to be leaving like they are.
What could Burgum have done?
I mean, we were trying to get H.R. 1260 attached to to the DOI appropriations bill in the House. It kind of went ignored. It didn't happen. And but this is, you know, we've been trying to do this for 6 years, and it still hasn't happened yet.
So I want you to hear what Mayor Muriel Bowser said yesterday about the problems with juveniles not being charged. Cut four.
And we have to have that honest conversation, too. We can't have a system where a juvenile or an adult can use guns, hurt people, and not face any accountability.
She could change it, right? Couldn't she pressure the city council? Couldn't she try to change that if she really thought it was a problem?
I believe so. I mean, I don't know all the laws as far as that goes with the city, but I do know, I mean, I'm pretty sure the mayor has pressured the city council. I think, you know, if you talk to Greg Pemberton, he's more involved with that, but there's a serious problem with the D.C. city council, and the mayor has limited power as far as that goes. Even when she's pressuring the city council, they have a lot of power to veto what she wants to do as well. And I know that that's been a problem in the city. So people in D.C. might want to start thinking about who they're voting for.
Absolutely. So the Park Police, during this time, they're going to get some more attention. They have the arrest authority. What do you think the National Guard can do? Is it purely as a deterrent? Do you think – how could they help your men and women?
I believe, like you said, Brian, it's definitely a deterrent. They can assist with crowd control. So they're already there. If things break bad, as far as like what happened in 2020, and if there's riots or civil unrest, they can definitely assist us with those kind of situations. But yeah, I would say that in a deterrent. So since they're already in place, it'll make it a lot easier to deploy them instead of trying to scramble and get them in when things have already gone crazy.
I want you to hear what Chief Pam Smith said yesterday about after the meeting yesterday about how they're going to coordinate Cut 8.
I answered to Mayor Muriel Bowser. Let me just say this. Let us not have any controversy with that, okay? Because I know people want to build upon and create division. We're here to work together with our federal partners, and that's what we're going to do.
All right. Cut seven.
What we've done at this point is we have provided the team, the administrator, with a strategic plan on how we will provide resources around our city. I think it's something that is doable. We know that we have to get illegal guns off of our street. And if we have this influx or enhanced presence, it's going to make our city even better.
So she's not that negative about it. You know, so she met with officials. What is the attitude like?
The attitude as far as who goes?
As far as the police getting along with National Guard and the FBI and the Park Police. How do they feel about this?
The attitude is great as far as the police goes. Are you asking what?
Is there coordination that she just spoke of?
It's great. I mean, I'm not going to disclose too much operational security stuff, but we have a great system going on right now. We do have a command center, and we are working closely with everybody that's on the ground in D.C., and everyone's working together very well.
23 arrests last night. So they're getting people off the streets, and hopefully they're good, not just around the monuments where you guys are, but they'll also be able to fan out to the surrounding working class areas. Final thoughts, Ken, about what we're doing, because other cities are looking and saying, can that work for us?
I believe it can. And I mean, it's going to take, you know, the city governments, the city councils in these large cities that have crime problems, they're going to have to rethink the way that they do things and start supporting the police. You know, if you support the police and we feel confident that we're not going to get in trouble for doing our jobs. I mean, let's be honest. There's been plenty of police officers, and I have some on my job right now, and I'll be talking to the DOI solicitor's office about it today. But, we have police officers that have been in trouble for doing their jobs, and that's it. And if we continue to feel like that, policing is not going to be the way it should be.
Gotcha. Kenneth Spencer, Chairman of the United States Park Police over in D.C. and New York, and the Fraternal Order of Police. Ken, thank you.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Stay safe. We're going to come back, take some of your calls. I'm also getting some emails about this whole new arrangement. Should it come to a city, especially if you got a hostile governor and mayor, is he going to put the wrong guys in the line of fire, if you know what I'm saying? Back in a moment.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So I can't get my head around this. I thought John Oliver was just mocking Chuck Schumer because Democrats are turning on Chuck Schumer. Instead, it turns out that Chuck Schumer's mocking Chuck Schumer. Get this, for over the last 15, 20 years, he, in order to act as if he's in touch with the average American in New York especially, he made up a family called the Baileys of Massapequa. And John Oliver couldn't believe it. So he took the cuts in real time of Chuck Schumer talking about the Baileys of Massapequa on all the issues of the day. Now, keep in mind, as you listen, the Baileys never existed. Although, once again, Massapequa is the problem. If it's not a serial killer, it's the Chiefs or the Baldwins are punching somebody, or Seinfeld is having an uproar. Let's listen.
But you heard him. The Baileys have guided Chuck Schumer's political life, which is a little weird given they don't exist. Seriously, he invented them. But crucially, for all he talks about how much he loves the Baileys, they don't seem to return that love. Of the 6 votes the Baileys had across the last 3 presidential elections, 5 went to Donald Trump, most recently because of crime. They also think the civil rights movement went too far and aren't against immigration, just illegal immigration. And this is the couple who, in Chuck Schumer's own words, have guided his political life. And at this point, it might be worth asking, is that a good idea? Because the truth is, Schumer's devotion to his imaginary friends may help explain why he and the Democratic Party have been so underwhelming in recent years. Because he seems to be focusing a huge amount on the interest of the Baileys from Long Island, while forgetting other voters actually exist.
And he goes on. I mean, you have him speaking and talking and addressing the Baileys. Over and over, I talked to the Baileys today. They voted for Reagan. They're against trickle-down economics. And I talked to the Baileys today, and the Baileys are for immigration, but not illegal immigration. And we thought, I mean, I actually never heard him say this. But I don't go on C-SPAN and listen to him. But it goes on. I mean, you wouldn't believe the amount of times he references. Evidently, he wrote a book that's 265 pages long on politics. And there's 264 references to the Baileys, who, again, just emphasize, do not exist. Let's listen.
They're a middle-class couple in Massapequa, which is a suburb on Long Island.
Joe and Eileen Bailey, this middle-class couple, they bought into Reagan Republicanism in 1980. Right.
Joe and Eileen are worried about losing their jobs or their friends' jobs.
The Baileys really don't believe in trickle-down. They don't believe in a whole lot of government spending, but they believe in tax breaks for kids to go to college.
He's an insurance adjuster and lives in the New York suburbs. By New York standards, he makes $50,000 a year. If he lived in the middle of the country, he'd make $40,000. Wife works in a medical office. She makes about 20. She might make 15 elsewhere.
Okay. By the way, do you see this? I believe that he believes that they exist. I believe that he started believing the Baileys existed. And I think they ended up being his only friends in the end. I don't want to give away the ending of Chuck Schumer's career, but this is impossible to explain. You know, people are going crazy. They're saying Donald Trump twice said that Vladimir Putin's going to Russia. And you have a guy for over 20 years who makes up a family, use him as a touchstone to policy decisions, and they don't exist. And people are worried about Donald Trump's mental capacity? Brian in Illinois. Hey, Brian.
Hey, I just want to say that a lot of people don't explain why communism is bad. The only reason communism exists is because it can fleece a rich economy. Russia started with a very rich economy. Then the Bolshevik Revolution started. They used it by splitting the people through economic and racial terms. And nobody seems to say that you can't start communism in Haiti. You can't control all the dirt. You know, there's nothing there to fleece.
But I'll tell you what, get used to it. But who's going to watch this debate again? Because the Democrats who are moderates are nowhere. But now you got a mayor candidate that's trying going to win in Minneapolis from Somalia, avowed socialist. Same thing in New York. And now over in Seattle, they're going to have three socialists, youngish, 30-somethings. I think the guy in Minneapolis might be 20-something. So they're going to talk about, they're going to get the new generation of Americans excited. And I agree with George Will. George Will says, you know what? Go ahead and do it. Although I don't want to see it happen in New York. I don't want Seattle and Minneapolis. Go ahead and do it. Watch it fail epically. But sadly, people are going to fail in their schools. They're going to kiss up to the teachers' unions. They're going to get rid of charter schools. They're going to tax the rich. They're going to move to other states. But that might be the ripple effect we need to have.
I'm Janice Dean. Join me every Sunday as I focus on stories of hope and people who are truly rays of sunshine in their community and across the world.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
I have one so much going on. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. As Mayor Adams says, everything's safe, so Mr. President, don't send any people in. It looks like we don't need the National Guard, if I'm to believe him. Of course, you don't want to go to the subways, but who goes there except for everybody? Brett Baer at the bottom of the hour. He's going to be heading to Alaska for the summit with Vladimir Putin. He's going to get the pre-interview with the president, and it looks like Sean Hannity is going to get the post-game. Tomorrow, President Trump will be on with us, so it's going to be great. And we'll see how long that goes. And I'll talk about Russia, but a lot of other things, too. In a matter of moments, going to go out to Ukraine and get a perspective on things from Daniel Bilak, who's a great friend of the show. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Tomorrow's move of president.
Conversations between Putin and Trump may be important for their bilateral, but they cannot agree on anything about Ukraine without us.
I agree with that 100%. 2 days into the Alaska summit, what does Vladimir Putin want out of it? We now know more details about the venue.
Number two.
What this tour is reflective of is the fact that Donald Trump is attacking this city. It's attacking its people. It's attacking the very fabric of what we call home. This is a tour against the Trump administration's attack on New York City voters.
Oh, really? This guy, what a treat. And I'm talking about Mr. Mondani. We are seeing a New York mayor's race, which is really a national story because it's socialism against capitalism. It's socialism against moderation on the Democratic Party. And right now, Mondami has opened up a 20-plus lead on Governor Cuomo.
Number one.
If he can get away with this in Los Angeles, if he can get away with this in D.C., it is a step in fascism when the federal government can bigfoot sovereign states.
Yeah, is there anything more irresponsible? For the most part, Mayor Bowser has been responsible. That statement is just for her base. 800 National Guard, FBI, flood the nation's capital to clean it up once and for all. Will it help? We're about to find out. 23 arrests last night. Most of the focus this week has been the buildup to the meeting with between Vladimir Putin and President Trump. On the sidelines for now is President Zelensky, and he is meeting with European leaders who are meeting with the president or have met with the president already about final instructions and things to get before we move to the next phase, which I'm sure will include President Zelensky, at least I hope. Daniel Bilak joins us now, member of the Territorial Defense Forces of Ukraine, former chief investment advisor to the prime minister. Daniel, welcome back. Your thoughts about what's going to take place Friday and how it's being portrayed in the Ukrainian press.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Well, you know, people are frustrated. They're disappointed. They're frustrated. The president lays down markers and then moves those markers. You know, every time he says that, you know, I demand a ceasefire and there are going to be consequences for Russia, he doesn't seem to follow through. And it's the problem is it's not a benign thing, because the problem is that when he does that, all that signals to President Putin is to double down and start bombing Ukrainians twice as badly. And we saw that in July after President Trump said that we're going to give him 50 days, all of 50 days, to comply. And we had the worst bombings probably of the entire war in the month of July. I mean, the places where the houses were just
just shaking, and it was really terrifying, I got to tell you. But, you know, hopefully, you know, people still believe in President Trump, and they're hoping that he's going to be able to rein in Vladimir Putin. Obviously, there's a lot of concern about a deal about Ukraine without Ukraine. But, you know, frankly, I think that the advisors around President Trump and President Trump himself understand that there's a lot at stake here. And, you know, he's been made to look very weak by Putin. And the president's got to be aware of that. And that's got to bother him. And I hope that this meeting is in some way and measure going to actually show that the U.S. has stiffened its resolve. You know, it's a pretty bad visual, though, that, you know, President Trump is meeting a terrorist of the kind that Putin on U.S. soil. I really wish he'd picked someplace else.
Why? What's the difference?
It's just, you know, you're rewarding Vladimir Putin with a propaganda victory that he says, you know, I'm now being rehabilitated because I've been invited to the United States. Although, having picked Alaska, a lot of the Russian nationalists and the Telegram channels are saying, well, we should claim Alaska back. You know, and Russia sold it to the United States in 1867. So they're saying, let's abrogate the treaty and claim Alaska back. But, you know, whatever the outcome, that's just one thing. But, you know, I really hope that Vladimir Putin doesn't gain in a meeting with the president what he can't gain on the battlefield.
So what is the battlefield like? I hear there's a major push for a land grab for Russia before this starts.
Yeah, they're throwing everything at us. You know, we've suffered losses. They've suffered even more losses, but they just keep throwing bodies at the front line. So far, we've contained them through the use and development of technology. We're probably the leading electronic warfare, drone warfare country in the world right now. But, you know, there are ebbs and flows to the battlefield. But he does not control the four oblasts that he claims. He doesn't even control the oblast centers, except in Luhansk, Zaporizhia, Kherson, and some of the others. He can't be able to get something out of President Trump that President Trump can't give. These are not places that it's.
But I think he knows that. I think Vladimir Putin knows it, that President Trump cannot unilaterally say, okay, here's the new deal. I think that I think the best scenario would be this. This is what Putin wants. It better not be the same stuff that he'd been saying for the last 2.5 years. And these are some of the things he wants. He takes it and we set up we work towards a trilateral meeting. And I think the European Union has made it clear there's got to be a protocol. And the protocol has got to be a ceasefire first. And then we have to look at security guarantees for Ukraine and then work from there.
That's exactly right. And I really hope that President Trump, he could actually turn this whole thing to his advantage dramatically by just saying, look, Putin, we're not talking about anything until you agree to a 30-day ceasefire, because that's been consistent. That's been the president's consistent position since the get-go. It's something that the Ukrainian government, that Zelensky accepted 5 months ago, and that Putin has just done everything to avoid. I mean, the man does not want peace. He still wants the whole country. And, you know, any peace that's forced on us is going to be not a peace but a pause before he moves again. I got to believe that the president and his advisors understand that.
So I saw a Gallup poll on Sunday that said that 2 years ago, the Ukrainians, 70% said, we do not stop fighting until we get all our land back. And now that number is 70%. They are for a negotiated peace. Can you give me Daniel Bilak's feeling about the attitude on the ground right now in Ukraine?
Yeah, I saw that was a Gallup poll. I think it was a little bit overstated, to be honest with you. I think that the sentiment right now is that we want a ceasefire, but we're not going to give up land to get it.
And people accept the fact that we may not get everything that, back that we want right now, because we don't have the equipment and the manpower to do it. Having said that, we've seen a reset in the relationship between the EU, Ukraine, and the United States, where the American taxpayer should be very happy about.
Yep.
We are buying equipment for America. We are creating American jobs and protecting ourselves. And
where NATO's buying it, right?
So it's a it's certain countries. NATO's distributing it. But there are certain key European countries, France, Britain, Germany, the Netherlands, and a few others that are footing the bill, Norway. And I think that if we can hold the fort on this if we get what we need. And frankly, Russia's in bad shape, Brian. It's something that doesn't get reported in the American press a lot. The economy's in a tailspin. They don't have the workers. They're using North Korean workers now in their factories. 60% of the shells that the Russians are using on the battlefield come from North Korea. So things aren't so great in Russia, and our intelligence services are really starting to take a piece out of Russia's arsenal. We bombed two manufacturing facilities that build these Iranian-designed Shahed drones that are now being produced in Russia in mass quantities. And these are the things that have been hitting our cities, in Kyiv in particular. But, we're starting to hit that. We've reduced their oil and petroleum production by 20%. Really what we need coming out of this is Vladimir Putin to lie to President Trump again, and for President Trump to say, that's it. I'm putting secondary sanctions like he did on India on everybody who deals with Russian oil or Russian products.
And it would be Turkey, Brazil. That would be Turkey, Brazil, and China?
Big squeeze, among others.
Would that be Turkey, Brazil, and China? Are there others they're buying oil from?
Yeah, among other countries as well. Yeah.
Okay.
And, the last time he put secondary sanctions on banks, the UAE, the Gulf states, the Arab states, and India and China stopped clearing Russian transactions in hours. So it can be very, very effective, and America has that clout. If the president chooses to really make life difficult for Vladimir Putin, probably at some cost to the global economy and American taxpayer, but it'll be a rounding error compared to the benefit that will bring
Daniel,
him to the table.
So if I was to, in practical terms, you tell me what does. I know what you want, and I know what I want, and everybody in the West wants, and everybody not out of Russia and China want, and that's them to get the hell out, including Crimea. It was an unprovoked invasion. I got it. But in reality, what does the end look like?
Well, it depends what you mean by the end.
Well,
right?
The end of the conflict. What is the end of the fighting look
the end
like?
Of the, well... At some point, I think you're going to have a ceasefire. That means that both sides are going to rearm. It probably means we'll be back at this again. Brian, Russia is an expansionist empire, and it will not stop until it is stopped or it falls apart. And I come back to this over and over again. The key to peace in Europe, not just peace in Ukraine, but peace in Europe and in America's best interest, so we can focus on China, is the defeat of the Russian army in Ukraine. And the Russian army is just meat right now. And they're using their aerial power the same way we are, the drones. People aren't even shooting at each other right now. It's all coming at you from the sky. It's machine-on-machine warfare. And we can take it to them, but we need more anti-missile systems from our allies, and we need help developing our own. We're now 40% of everything we use is now made in Ukraine. We need help scaling that. So so we can mass produce it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Russian army can be defeated in Ukraine. We've done it at least twice where we had them on the ropes. And then the Biden administration and the Scholz administration pulled us back and said, no, we don't want Russia to lose. We don't want Russia to collapse. And we're afraid of escalation and nuclear war and all that stuff. But, ultimately, the only way this ends, Brian, is if Russia can't do this again. And that's a combination military force, economic force, and political isolation.
Daniel, best of luck. We're pulling for you. And I'd be very curious to get the aftermath next week. So hopefully we'll catch up to you again.
Happy to talk to you again, Brian.
All right.
Take care,
buddy. Daniel Bilek, calling us from Ukraine, the reality on the ground. A lot at stake this Friday. Brett Baer, at the bottom of the hour, your calls next, 1-866-408-7669. The president already met with the European Union. They had, a Zoom call. He also met with Zelensky. Like I said, a Zoom call. He might have been part of it because I believe he was with the German chancellor when they made the call. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's the Will Cain Show. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday on FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss a show. Get the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's insane how Putin has just completely disregarded what anybody else wants. What does your gut tell you about Friday's meeting?
Well, I think it's a feel-out meeting, to be honest. I think here's the way I would describe it. The president talked to Putin on the phone four times, okay? And, you know, nothing's come of it, or at least we haven't gotten to where we want to be. And so the president feels like, look, I got to look at this guy across the table. I need to see him face to face. I need to hear him one-on-one. I need to make an assessment by looking at him. And people have to understand, for President Trump, a meeting is not a concession.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't look like that. He looks at it as a business. And that's when one thing I think Europe is beginning to pick up. I don't think Democrats understand it, but he's unorthodox. Stop saying that, well, you know, you got to send State Department people there, diplomats there, your Secretary of State. And when it's almost done, the last mile should be done by the chief executive. He doesn't do things like that. So just stop scoring it the way it's traditionally done. Steve in New York. Hey, Steve.
Good morning. Amen to that, what you just said, without a doubt. But I just wanted to give you my takeaway on the interview that you just had with the journalist that basically is embedded in Ukraine.
Well, he's a former government official with the previous regime. Go ahead.
Okay. So with that said, I understand, you know, both sides are digging in. They want to have their posturing to the point where they're making peace to be, unreachable. And, Putin has his end game, and so does Zelensky. But, and Trump has the card putting out more oil in the U.S. That's going to drive the price of oil down to the point where it's going to, like, really hurt Russia's economy even more. And even with China and India and Brazil, whoever is buying his oil— you know, that's not going to be able to make up the difference in the pricing. That being said, with Zelensky needs to bend a little bit. You know, they can't just be burying bodies on both sides. They need to be able to extend olive branches so they can, you know, right. Get a peace.
We'll see. There's been no offer except the ridiculous parameters that Russia put out, which are non-starters. We'll see if he comes. He must have said something to Steve Witkoff, and I talked to his son, Zach Witkoff, today, that made the president feel as though something could be done here today. I'll ask the president that tomorrow on our show. He will be our guest. I believe we're the only interview he's doing tomorrow. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Brett Baer next.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
We're in unprecedented territory. The law says he has 30 days unless the Congress passes a joint resolution to extend it. Because there is no real predicate, in our view, for a crime surge that caused the emergency, having the reasons to end the emergency are also unclear. So that's the conversation that I will have with the person that he has designated as his proxy to request these services, and that's the Attorney General Bondi.
So the mayor, who's been up and down with their description and just put out a statement earlier saying, oh, I really great like dealing with Attorney General Pam Bondi. He also was quoted as saying that the president is acting in a fascist tone. So which one is it? Brett Baer joins us now. And of course, the mayor of D.C. now has about 800 more law enforcement agents from National Guard to FBI agents helping her out in a city that she says is doing fine. Brett Baer, what's the reality? I know you live in a couple of places and you spend a lot of time traveling. Brett Baer, you're chief political anchor of Fox News. Just in case you don't know, you know, you have a book coming out. It's called Rescue the American Spirit, Teddy Roosevelt and the Birth of a Superpower. So, Brett, what's the reality when you talk to your friends and colleagues about crime in D.C.? What's your reality?
Yeah, I mean, here's the reality. I had a house that was just north of Georgetown in a really nice area called, you know, Northwest. But it's a great area to live. And we obviously raised our family there. I now spend, you know, half the week here and the family's down in Florida. But just to give you an example, like only a few months ago, midday, about 3 p.m., a guy three blocks from my house at the time was bumped in from behind from another car. And he pulled over to, you know, how you would do to get the insurance and deal with the accident. And three guys pop out of the car, masked with guns, and take his car, carjacked, and took his car away. 3 o'clock in the afternoon in a really nice part of Washington, D.C. My point is that everybody has one of these stories. And, you know, whether you're Republican or Democrat or independent, there are increasing issues with this kind of crime, not only violent crime, but that kind of carjacking and also property crime. So everybody knows it. Democrats will tell it to you. I had Adrian Elrod on my show last night on Special Report saying, yeah, it is an issue. And so, you know, for anybody who says that, you know, it's just not necessary, a lot of people will tell you that they welcome the action. Now, whether how it lasts, where it goes from here, I think are all questions.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll see what happens with the increased presence. But I also hope they go into the more urban areas, you know, the more the projects, the more rundown working class areas. Do you think
100%,
they will?
Yeah, that's where the real issues. Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully that'll happen. But we do have these tragic situations that are happening in nice neighborhoods when Redskins running backs get shot on when they're trying to get their car out of valet. So we're seeing that happening. But Brett, it's kind of interesting because the mayor doesn't really know how to act. She's all over the place. One minute she's condemning, the next minute she's praising him. Do you think she's getting pressure from her own party?
I think so. I think she has to be, because her original initial statement was to welcome the cooperation and to praise the Attorney General for, you know, how they're working together, and to praise, you know, all of the leaders she was talking to. And then, you know, a day sort of transpired, and there was another message about authoritarian actions and worry about expansion.
Brett Baer with us now. And Brett, you're going to be going to Alaska, I understand. What is the schedule and what are you hearing? I know we're going to the U.S. The venue is going to be a military base, right?
Yeah, it'll be a military base in Anchorage. And You know, it's fascinating. I'll be traveling on Air Force One. I'll talk to the president on the way over there. And then we have a number of things on the ground, including doing my show, Special Report. But it is going to be fascinating to see exactly how he characterizes this and what comes out of it. We are working to try to get Vladimir Putin on, and we're in talks, believe it or not, with that. And we'll see. But there may be a joint press conference. We don't know because it's so fluid at this point. But I'll be on the trip.
Wow, that'd be interesting. Have you ever interviewed him?
Putin? No. I've had different officials from Russia on, including his big economic negotiator. But we aspire to have at least his individual reaction to what came out of the summit.
That'll be interesting. I'm trying to get a read, and we have President Trump on tomorrow on the radio show, which I know you'll be listening to. I'm trying to get a read on what Steve Witkoff learned from Vladimir Putin that made him call the president and say, it's worth your time. And I haven't gotten any specific thing. I heard about the swaps. There's confusion on. What do you think what's behind Vladimir Putin going for this now?
You know, I can't put a finger on it yet. I don't know if it's the initial to try to get to negotiating. I think it's bigger as far as, a trade situation with the U.S. to open up economic channels. I think that the efforts to pinch Russia may be having an effect, and they could step up. You know, they could increase with another tariff on China in coming weeks for buying Russian oil. That's already happened, 25% more to India. Eventually, that hurts an economy that's already stressed in a number of different ways. So, you know, it's interesting that both sides are also bringing their economic advisors. And maybe this is part of a big, broader deal that ties to that. But whatever happens, the Ukrainians have to be at the table to decide what they can or cannot do.
Absolutely. And the thing is, too, I understand there was a Zoom call with European leaders and Zelensky, and there's a protocol that they want to relay. They want to say you got to ask for it in a nice way. Trump doesn't take orders well. In a nice way, they say you got to have ceasefire and security guarantees 1 and 2. So what does that look like in reality?
Yeah, I mean, I really don't know. And I think, you know, there's all kinds of people in Washington, Democrats and Republicans, who are skeptical about Putin, period, because he has a long history of dealing with things that have not panned out. And obviously the European leaders are worried that they agree to something and then, you know, he tears it up in a year or two and then starts moving again.
Yeah,
and starts moving again. So hence the security guarantee.
All right, we'll see what's going to happen. But I just don't know, like, Brett, I know you have a lot of friends. I just don't know what ones are imaginary, so you could choose to tell me which aren't. But I found out that Chuck Schumer's got an imaginary friend. So what you're about to hear is John Oliver, who discovered it as well. And believe it or not, it's from my town of Massapequa again. Let's listen.
But you heard him. The Baileys have guided Chuck Schumer's political life, which is a little weird given they don't exist. Seriously, he invented them. But crucially, for all he talks about how much he loves the Baileys, they don't seem to return that love. Of the 6 votes the Baileys had across the last 3 presidential elections, 5 went to Donald Trump, most recently because of crime. They also think the civil rights movement went too far and aren't against immigration, just illegal immigration. And this is the couple who, in Chuck Schumer's own words, have guided his political life. And at this point, it might be worth asking, is that a good idea? Because the truth is, Schumer's devotion to his imaginary friends may help explain why he and the Democratic Party have been so underwhelming in recent years. Because he seems to be focusing a huge amount on the interest of the Baileys from Long Island, while forgetting other voters actually exist.
For example, I know people's heads are spinning now, they're saying, what am I talking about? I didn't know about this till I watched it, but this is what Chuck Schumer said about the Baileys, who don't exist, multiple times.
They're a middle-class couple in Massapequa, which is a suburb on Long Island.
Joe and Eileen Bailey, this middle-class couple, they bought into Reagan Republicanism in 1980. Joe and Eileen
are worried about losing their jobs or their friends' jobs.
The Baileys really don't believe in trickle down. They don't believe in a whole lot of government spending, but they believe in tax breaks for kids to go to college.
He's an insurance adjuster and lives in the New York suburbs. By New York standards, he makes $50,000 a year. If he lived in the middle of the country, he'd make $40,000. Wife works in a medical office. She makes about $20,000. She might make $15,000 elsewhere.
Okay, so just keep in mind, none of that is real. Brett, I don't want to put you on the spot, but have you made things up in the past? Or are there your neighbors that don't exist? Has anything like this ever happened to you?
No, it's not. Listen, I saw that. I thought Oliver did an amazing job laying it out. I hadn't known any of that. I guess it's a story that first popped up years ago in the New Yorker, but really didn't get a lot of traction. But he continues to use the Baileys, and not in a broad way, but in a very specific way, like with very specific details. Like Joe stands up at the Rangers games and takes off his hat. She's very upset about, problems in the school, and then goes into their kids, who then have names, who are also make-believe. It's very bizarre, and it's getting a lot of attention online. We're going to try to talk to the Senate Minority Leader at some point and see if we can turn a story about the Baileys.
And by the way, if there were their Baileys, I would have bumped into them at Uncle Giuseppe's in Massapequa, but there was no one to bump into because they weren't there, even though they...
I get the point. You know, he's trying to use this couple that votes different ways. They're really independent, but here's why they're a lodestar. But he could have said a make-believe family, but he uses them as real people.
Brett, it's just crazy between what's going on with the president. Every day is different, but it's definitely exciting. Lastly, any word about the Texas lawmakers coming back on the gerrymander? Because last night ABC was reporting they were going to go back home.
Yeah, we don't have word that that's happened yet. They did not get a quorum again today. I do think that the pressure is on both from the FBI and from Texas officials and where Governor Abbott is. I'm watching now the president at the Kennedy Center announcing the new Kennedy Center honorees. It is quite something to see him take control of kind of every aspect of Washington, D.C. Congratulations to Sylvester Stallone, a friend of ours, who is going to be an honoree, as well as Kiss. I mean, and Michael Crawford. I mean, you can see the song list already in President Trump's eyes of what he's going to hear in December.
Crazy times. But Sylvester Stallone, at one point, I was better friends with him than you. And that has totally turned on its head. Now it's Brett Baer and Brian Kilmeade's an afterthought. So I don't know how I lost that friendship.
It's just proximity. Right. It's just proximity.
I mean, when I used to say, yeah, I know Sylvester Stallone, people say, Brian, you're making that up. Little do we know that I was actually telling the truth and Chuck Schumer was making up somebody in my own town.
It's not the Baileys.
It's absolutely not. Hey, I cannot wait for your book that can be pre-ordered now, To Rescue the American Spirit, Teddy Roosevelt, and the Birth of a Superpower. Brett?
Yeah, really psyched. Really psyched about it.
It's great.
It's going to be good.
Yeah, it's really great, and we love Teddy Roosevelt. Thanks so much, Brett.
See ya.
I'm going to be speaking about Teddy Roosevelt on the 23rd of August. Fox Nation's going to stream it Saturday night. History, Liberty, and Laughs. And also Sam Houston, the Alamo Avengers, appropriately. I'll move that up on the list, even though it's the fourth history book, and I'm going to bring history to life, and we're going to have a great time. I'll see everybody in Dallas. BrianKilmeade.com.
This is serious stuff.
Breaking news. The latest headlines.
Exciting commentary.
People are aroused. I haven't seen people so aroused in a very, very long time.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
His name is
Sylvester Stallone. It's very few, almost, if any, people that could have taken a name and made it so incredible, like Rocky, Rambo, Creed, and others. But think of it, Rocky, Rambo, if you did one, you're good. You do two. And I'll never forget, I was a young guy, and I went to see a thing called Rambo, and it had just come out. I didn't know anything about it, but I was in a movie theater, like we used to go to movie theaters a lot. And I said, this movie is phenomenal. What the heck? And that turned out to be a monster. Rocky is Rocky.
And then he's describing 1976 when he went to the movies and got, it was the movie of the year, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, Rocky, best picture, I don't know if he won best director. Yeah, they may have won best director, right. But definitely won best picture, yeah.
So he gets it. So the President of the United States is giving the reading out the nominations for the Trump Kennedy Center.
It's like a game show because he's right. Got like
a... But he also says, I'm going to fix the grounds. I know grass. Grass gets tired. Grass has got a life like all human beings. He does know grass. And then I'm thinking to myself, does he really know grass? Yeah. He goes, you don't have a golf course if you don't know grass. So he's going to get grass. You know what's the next thing he's going to do? That park across the street from the White House is an embarrassment. You know the one where they try to pull down the Andrew Jackson statue?
Yeah.
That's it. That is an embarrassment. And I know the president's going to go, what the hell is going on here? You'd say, oh, it's all dirt. So hopefully he'll fix that. So he's announcing this as if it's the Academy Awards. This
because he's unveiling them, and he's got, for the people that are listening, he's got a curtain thing over these portraits. So when he announces the name, then he has these two ladies pull down the piece of paper or the cloth to unveil an artist drawing of the nominee.
So Gloria Gaynor also got in. It looks like you have George Strait, legend in country music. He got in. George Crawford, Michael Crawford. Who is he? Do you know?
I believe he's a British actor.
All right. Does he have the accent?
That I don't know.
Can you find out, Eric?
I'm really wondering why he picked Rambo as the one that he saw in the theater, not Rocky. He talked about Rambo.
He said Rocky.
No, he said Rocky, but he talked about seeing the movie Rambo, and that's the one that knocked his socks off.
It was First Blood.
Yeah, that's
it. And I remember going to the theater like, well, if it's Stallone, I'm going to watch it, right? And I go, unbelievable. I thought First Blood was it.
Yeah.
And then it became almost a cartoon.
Well, it became a comic book, basically. But the first one is as grounded as you can get.
Yeah, because it's a Vietnam veteran who snaps. And sadly, it happens.
You know who was supposed to play that role years ago? I mean, Pacino was attached to it. Steve McQueen wanted to play it.
Steve McQueen would have worked. But Pacino's not athletic enough.
Yeah.
You need to look like a Special Forces guy. And back then, Special Forces guys were huge. They weren't like the 5'9", 180 guys now. These guys were huge. So it made total sense. Remember, they're all dead, sir.
It's a great, powerful scene. And that movie was, the original cut was over 3 hours, and it was so bad and slow that Stallone wanted to shelve the movie and never have it shown until he personally edited it in half and it became a hit.
You know what's amazing? You know what's underappreciated? He's an athlete. I mean, this stuff that this guy does, I mean, he's hanging off. Remember he did that other song, like Cliffs?
Cliffhanger, yeah.
Yeah, Cliffhanger. He also tried to get another series going, Cobra. That never really took
off. That was originally going to be Beverly Hills Cop. He backed out, and then he turned the script that he wrote into Cobra.
And the one I love best, better than Rocky, Rhinestone with Dolly Parton.
Great singing.
Because I always said,
Drinkenstein.
Yeah, he's a good boxer, but man, he's a better singer. And I actually brought that up to him, and I am name dropping, because Bret Baier is now better friends with him. How I lost that unique Fox Stallone friendship. I don't know. Is it me? I'm not sure.